Welcome to the Freedom Report, broadcasting from Alexandria, Virginia. Welcome to the Freedom Report. I'm your host, Austin Peterson. Who's Austin Peterson?
Liberty champion Austin Peterson, this Justin Bieber lookalike, and a powerful advocate for liberty.
Who's Austin Peterson? I'm an American. I love life, liberty, and family, but I'm not a conservative. I'm a hardcore libertarian. What am I doing here? I'm trying to restore the republic. The Libertarian Republic is a website aimed at furthering the ideas of economic freedom and personal liberty. I don't really care about parties. All I care about are ideas. And the one idea I care the most about? Freedom! That's right, pure freedom on the Freedom Report podcast.
Jeffrey Tucker is the CLO, that is the Chief Liberty Officer of Liberty.me. He's also a distinguished fellow at the Foundation for Economic Education. All right, so let's get right into it. Today we're going to start the conversation, talk a little bit about Bitcoin, then we're going to get into economics as a whole and some of the social issues that intertwine with libertarianism. So let's start.
Okay.
So the big news today, Jeffrey, is that there is a new game in town. There's a new Bitcoin mining agency that supposedly has 51% of the computational power devoted to mining Bitcoins.
Yeah.
Now, the speculation on the market is that these people will be able to block transactions of other people being able to engage in transactions from Bitcoin. So basically, people are worried that because these people have 51% of the control of mining capabilities, that this small syndicate will be able to stop people from being able to buy and sell in Bitcoins. Are you afraid of this, and what do you think about this new development?
I think it's all a bunch of mythology. It's not in anybody's interest to control the bulk of the Bitcoin market, because it would drive down the price dramatically and they'd be stuck. So it would be a terrible move on their part. You know, the fact that everybody knows about this, and this is sort of, you know, the word on the street, is great to me, because it shows just how open the whole system is. You know, unlike central banking, unlike the world financial cartel, which is all behind closed doors, everything that takes place in the Bitcoin world is open source. So everybody knows about it. What it leads to is periodic hysterias, and they come about, every 4, 5, 6 weeks, there's some frenzy. Oh my God, here's a terrible flaw in Bitcoin that's going to be killed. This is just another case of that.
Okay, so you wrote a piece recently where you argued that Bitcoins are uniquely Austrian. And for those of our listeners who might not be familiar, Austrian economics is the school of economics most closely associated with scholars such as Friedrich Hayek, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, and other people. Jeffrey Tucker, I think he considers himself an Austrian. I don't want to speak for you, though. But you wrote that you saw that Bitcoins were uniquely Austrian. Most people, when they think of Austrian, though, they think of hard money. They think of hard currency. Think Ron Paul, he's an Austrian economist. But Bitcoin is the kind of thing that you don't really own something physical. Why do you argue that Bitcoins are uniquely Austrian?
Well, it took me a while to come to this conclusion. I mean, it took me about a year of hard thinking for exactly the reason you mentioned it. You mostly associate Austrian economics with hard money and gold. It's like, okay, here's a weird internet currency made of ones and zeros. What does that have anything to do with each other? So it took me like a year to figure this out, and I figured it out like one point at a time. First of all, the Austrian tradition begins with Karl Menger, who argued that money comes out of the market experience and emerges out of real trading and real entrepreneurship. That's exactly how Bitcoin emerged, the same way. Mises argued that you don't have to have a constantly increasing supply of money. It can be basically a fixed point in time like gold, and that's exactly what Bitcoin is. Rothbard, you know, argued that really banks should be like 100% reserved, so that money is really wholly owned as private property. That's exactly what Bitcoin is. Kirchner said that entrepreneurship is an important part of the market process, and that's what's going on with Bitcoin. You've got a whole commercial infrastructure arising out of this basically commodity-like money. I especially like the fact that Bitcoin doesn't depend on third parties, and that is very much integral to the whole Austrian theory of what money is. Money is a plain good. It's like a market good. It's a commodity. It should be traded like any other, without any special state privileges or central powers or anything like that, and that's exactly what Bitcoin is. So in that sense, it's totally integrated into the Austrian tradition. It just takes a while to figure it out.
Okay. All right. So for the most hardcore of hardcores who are listening to us, the ones who really like love the nuance in these debates, I'm going to throw them a bone here and ask you a question. Because you brought up Murray Rothbard and his case for 100% reserves in banking. There's sort of a debate in the Austrian community about this concept, where Murray Rothbard says that that banks really should just be holding. They should just be holding, you know, your money for you. And some people are saying that fractional reserve is inherently fraudulent. But if I have a contract with a bank, you know, can't I go make a voluntary contract with a bank saying, oh gosh, you can hold 2% of my reserves if you want to? I mean, the difference with the Federal Reserve is that it's fiat. I mean, inherently it's fractional, but they force us to use the money rather than a private contract. So, do you agree with Murray Rothbard, or do you disagree and think that even private contracts of fractional reserve are valid?
Well, I've been listening to this debate for 30 years and tried to carefully consider all points of view. And a lot of the fractional reserve case for fractional reserve banking depends on what kind of contract it is. Is the money immediately available or is it not? In other words, is it a demand deposit or a time deposit? These things are so complicated. They get into all sorts of complex areas of institutions and contracts and things. And I generally am favorable towards 100% reserve position. But you know what I've always wanted to see, Austin, is a real experiment in which we have really strict property rights and watch how the system emerges naturally in absence of government intervention. And
right.
The beautiful thing about Bitcoin is like we're getting a good case in point. We get to watch this market emerge and see basically how this debate is going to be settled. Sometimes these academic debates all take place in the realm of big fat books and ideas, you know?
Yeah.
And have very little to do with reality. Well, now we've got reality, and that's really going to help us, I would say.
That's fantastic. I mean, Bitcoin is so exciting to me just because it's like you said, it's happening in the real world. We're actually getting to see our principles being put into practice. And no matter what all the doom and gloom sayers out there in the financial world say, it's managed to be resilient. There was a really fantastic story we covered last week at the Libertarian Republic about this young man who's 15 years old, and he turned $1,000 into $100,000 using Bitcoin. And he basically got a promise from his parents, if he made $1 million before he's 18, he won't have to go to college, which I thought was pretty cool.
It's exciting to think how Bitcoin could change our culture and get rid of this idea that we shouldn't be saving money. Maybe it'll incentivize saving and start to change our value structure. You know, right now we have placed a high value on spending and materialism and consumption. You know, maybe with a currency that's rising in value, we're going to start thinking a little bit more about the long term, start saving money, and stop with this insane spending debt-based economy that we have. It's a very interesting prospect. That will change who we are as people.
All right. Well, so I've softballed you enough, Jeffrey. Now I'm going to ease you into the little bit more difficult topics, and we're going to go medium hard on this next question. There's a lot of controversy over the fact that Seattle recently raised their minimum wage to $15 an hour. What do you think about the minimum wage increase? Dave Bratt, who was the guy who unseated Eric Cantor out here in Virginia, it was widely seen as a crazy upset. He was asked a question about the minimum wage as an economist, and he dodged it. He said, because they asked him, do you think we should even have a minimum wage at all? And he goes, well, I don't have a polished answer for that, you know. And I was kind of like, oh, good dodge. But like, if he really if he's staying true to his real roots, which a lot of people say he's an Austrian, they say he's one of us. Don't you think that we don't need a minimum wage at all? What do you think about what Seattle's doing, Jeffrey?
I think all minimum wages are a violation of human rights. They basically prevent you from making contracts that you want to do. And they make it impossible for people to get jobs. I mean, I think basically you would have to be practically an idiot not to understand that. I'm sorry, I have so much intolerance for this view. I'm very aware of this history. 100 years ago, Austin, you know, the minimum wages were proposed as a way to keep black people out of the market. You know, that was the purpose of them.
Heartless, evil, capitalist, racist pig. Well, Jeffrey, you know you don't have to convince me. You're preaching to the choir here. The people who watch my show, the people who listen to my show, the 50 to 80,000 people who listen to my show every day, thank you very much for listening, ladies and gentlemen. They know exactly what we're talking about. But for some reason, this message can't seem to get across the left. You know, I have debates with liberals all the time, and I actually think that I'm one of the better libertarians who's able to sort of like couch libertarian radical ideas, which abolishing the minimum wage is a radical idea nowadays, yeah. unfortunately. But I mean, I think I'm pretty good at couching, you know, the minimum wage debate in an abolish, being able to say, hey, yeah, I want to abolish it. How do you approach that with someone that you actually want to convince, not somebody that you just want to kind of like hit over the head with the brutalist club, which we'll get into later?
Well, I mean, you can use simple examples like if eggs were $12 a carton at the grocery store, would you buy them or would you find some substitute? And they would say, I wouldn't pay $12 for a carton of eggs. Okay, well, if you've got an employee who's only producing a net value product of $5 an hour, why would you pay them $15? You're basically losing $10 for every hour you employ them. I mean, that's dumb. You, as a business person, you would never do that.
Well, because eggs don't vote for politicians, Jeffrey.
Yeah, that's the problem. So a basic price, a price issue of prices, but there's also, to me, it's also an issue of liberty. We have so many labor regulations in this country, and they are crushing a whole generation of young people in particular. People are not being allowed into the markets. It is so hard for people to get jobs. And by the way, I think something just as egregious as minimum wages are child labor laws. They are the dumbest things. You talk about a violation of human rights. A smart 12, 13, 14-year-old kid who wants to get out in the marketplace, commercial marketplace, and provide value and experience what it's like to serve other people, it's illegal. I mean, this is what we've got going on in this country.
All right, so I want to ease you into something even a little more controversial, and it's something that you've written about. It's big in the news right now. Obviously, we all know that the Pope has come out and said, you know, that he's very much for equality. He's used a lot of socialist rhetoric while not necessarily saying he's a socialist, and he's sort of pushed back against the idea that he might be a Marxist. But Pope Francis has used a lot of anti-capitalist rhetoric. Now, Jeffrey, you're a practicing Catholic, and you wrote recently that you think that that capitalism is the only way that Catholics can go. There was a cardinal, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, who just recently came out and said, you cannot be a Catholic if you are for free market capitalism. And I mean, come on now, a lot of the rhetoric from the Bible is helping the poor, and it sounds like a lot of socialist rhetoric coming from the Bible. Tell me, as a practicing Catholic, Jeffrey, what do you think of when you hear the words from the cardinal and from the Pope like this?
I just think they don't know what they're talking about. They don't understand economics, and they don't understand human liberty. And I'll tell you something else they don't understand, which is the state, which is a violent, vicious institution that's just constantly looting people on behalf of the power elite. With this kind of language coming from top clerics and the Pope, all they're doing is empowering the powerful even more. They're not helping the poor. It doesn't cause the poor to be helped. I mean, you could loot the world's 10,000 most richest people today and have enough money to make everybody, you know, a few bucks richer for about a month, and that would be the end of it. Redistribution is not the basis of a world economy. We've got 7 billion people to feed on this planet. You've got to have a gigantic and hugely operating, massively capitalized, free market capitalist economy to make this system work. And this kind of socialist rhetoric is practically impossible. It's also morally evil, I would say, in the sense that it all it does is sort of bolster the most powerful violent forces in the world. I mean, I know many people who think this way. I know many cardinals, you know, I've had discussions with them. I'm headed off tomorrow to go to a conference with 1,300 people where a lot of people are going to be talking about these issues. The problem is that the people who talk like this have not considered, first of all, the true nature of what liberty is, and they've not considered the true nature of what the state is. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of times, quite frankly, Austin, if I could just put it like really bluntly and a little bit cynically, I think a lot of this language and a lot of these papers and this stuff, it's just done to please New York Times, basically. They're looking for plaudits from what they know are the established press. They, you know, I mean, the Catholic Church feels very defensive about itself. It's this sort of weird medieval institution run by an all-male club of celibates and very unfashionable. And sometimes these guys are just kind of looking for somebody to praise them from time to time. The easiest way to get that done is to talk favorably about socialism and socialistic policies.
Okay, well, I wasn't going to bring it up but you said it. You said celibates. So one of the big concerns of the Catholic Church is that they might, you know, the Pope might suddenly say that the priests can get married. What did you think about that?
That's a matter of administrative decision. It doesn't have anything to do with doctrine and faith. You know, nobody's asked me my opinion on that, and they probably won't. I wouldn't see that as a calamity in any sense. You know, I mean, the Eastern Church has married priesthood. That's no big deal.
Cool.
I mean, I would argue from a libertarian point of view, I think the Catholic Church has a right to run its own affairs how it wants to. If it wants to maintain an all-male priesthood of celibates, that's its business. If it wants to change and adopt some of the practice, that's fine. These are matters of so-called discipline that really don't impact on anything more fundamental than that. That's funny you asked me that question.
Well, you said celibate, so I wasn't going to ask that until you said that word. But all right, so I want to ask you another question, and this will be our final topic. You wrote an article called Humanitarians versus Brutalists, and you sort of gave rise inadvertently to this kind of subculture of libertarians, these people that call themselves brutalists. Now, I don't think there's nobody out there that are really calling themselves humanitarians, but there's sort of the great unwashed of the movement that's sort of risen up and taken the label of brutalists.
Yeah.
And these people they sort of revel in being disgusting. I know. I mean, do you have any regrets about writing that article and sort of like giving solidarity to this group of cretins?
Not really. I kind of delight in the fact that, first of all, that my words had some power and some influence on history. That's always great. I enjoy coining a new term, which is very hard to do as a writer. Yeah, that's really hard. It's really hard. And I also like that it did give rise to this kind of self-conscious movement, because I like the fact that like no one person's like in control of the problem. And when things turn out like a little bit different from what you expected, it slightly delights me in a way. I wouldn't even call them the great unwashed. I mean, you know, I said in my article that brutalism is an element. It's maybe the starting point of any belief in liberty. It's, you know, don't tread on me. This is very important to have this attitude of resistance to the state. I mean, it's the foundation of liberty. My main point was that we need to kind of like go up from that and understand that liberty is not just about my rights and your rights. It's really about a flourishing social order.
Right, but
that was my main point.
I want to nitpick for a second, because you know, one of the things that you and I try and do is we try and get these principles accepted by the middle class. You know, Saul Alinsky, when he wrote Rules for Radicals, Saul Alinsky hated the hippies of the leftist movement of the 1960s. He couldn't stand them. You know why? Because he was telling people that if the radicals, people like you and I, want to have our ideas accepted in society, we have to cut our hair, wear a tie, put on a suit, and infiltrate. And a couple of weeks ago, me and my associate editor, we did a podcast about these guys who went into Chipotle looking all nasty and carrying their rifles at low ready, looking like they were getting ready to shoot up the Chipotle, right? And then they took a picture of themselves, and then the anti-gun groups came out and said, oh, hey, look at those people. You know, these are obviously psychopaths. So, I mean, you know, look at how you're dressed now. Look at how I'm dressed. Not quite as nice as you, perhaps. But the thing is that if I have radical ideas, you know, Saul Alinsky said, the more radical your ideas you are, the more you're going to have to sort of come off as looking middle class and seeming not as radical, because if you walk in the door and with a rifle at low ready with, you know, military, you know, camo on and you're wearing sunglasses, people might rightly even pull a gun on you thinking that you're going to shoot up the place. So, I mean, don't you think that we have to be honest in saying, hey, you know, if you're going to be doing this kind of activism, there's a better way to do it? Because a lot of people seem resistant to that. There's a whole egalitarian streak. This is what I'm getting at, Jeffrey. There's this egalitarian streak of like, oh, well, yeah. and they're sort of equating telling people how to do liberty activism better. They're equating that with statism. They're like, oh, you're telling me how to dress nice. That's status. That's status. I'm like, no, these people, this is like the retard caucus here going on, and I'm not afraid to call it out because I'm not egalitarian, Jeffrey. I inherently think people are better than others. But there's this weird sort of like strange like strata of egalitarians. What do you think about that? Don't dodge me, Jeffrey.
Yeah, no. I mean, you've said so many funny and cool things. Here's what I would, because I only have, like, I can only answer one of the points. Right. For me, my radicalism, my basically anarchism, which I know you don't even quite accept, right? But I mean, like, at my very core, I'm like an anarchist radical. Sure. For me, that is, how do I put this, very normal. Like I believe in this so solidly and so strongly and so much at my very core with every breath that I take and everything I write, mm-hmm. that I don't feel as if I need to kind of like hurl myself around in wild, crazy ways to kind of illustrate how radical I am. And my radicalism is like so integral to the way I think that I'm happy to be as bourgeois, you know, as I want to be. I don't fear that. I'm not defensive about that. I'm glad to debate with anybody at any time. So yeah, I think a certain level of sort of life normalcy is a kind of a, you know, is what we should all strive to achieve. And we should be so comfortable in our ideological radicalism that it's not something we have to, you know, constantly, like everywhere at the grocery store, go up to, you know, anybody and tell them, you know, don't tread on me. I mean, we don't have to do this all the time, I guess.
Okay.
So, yeah, I mean, to me, my anarchism is not a personal preference, all right? It really, really is a conception of how the social order, you know, does and should and can work. And I believe that with all my heart, so.
All right. Answer, Jeffrey. It's a difficult subject for sure, because you know the people who are going to be listening to this are just waiting to jump on us because they want to get us, you know. But I don't care. I mean, come at me, bro. You know, I mean, my attitude is not necessarily to be confrontational, but it is very much a don't tread on me. And I think that, you know, I think that there are better ways to do things, Jeffrey. I think that if we, here's the thing. I feel like some libertarians sort of reject Ayn Rand. And I mean, like, I don't accept everything Ayn Rand says, but like, you know, they're like, oh, well, like people say, Austin, you've got such a big ego. You know what I mean? And I'm like, yeah, you know what? If I did not think that I could achieve greatness, how could I ever achieve greatness? You know what I mean? There's like a resistance against striving towards bettering oneself. It's like, we're all the same. We're all the same sludge. I'm like, no, you may be sludgy and scummy and scummy, but I'm not. I mean, do you see that or not?
What is the last thing you said? You just slightly cut out.
My question is that, do you see that there's like a resistance against greatness sometimes in amongst our, you know, our clan or tribe, perhaps, that there's like, there's a resistance against striving towards something great? It's like, you think you're better than me? You know, yeah, if I didn't think I was better than you, why the hell would I be trying to do this?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. I've never really experienced that myself. I mean, I kind of, I'm not sure about that, but I believe that might be part of it. You know, if libertarianism is going to really become a big deal, it's got to include a huge swath of the population. So,
sure.
I wanted to apply to, you know, what I would like to see, Austin, the same thing you would like to see, is a greater degree of sort of tolerance in all directions, you know? Uh-huh. I mean, it's like, I'm not interested in purging anybody, really. You know, I have a kind of, like, I have an appreciation for a lot of different cultural points of view, you know, styles of life and that kind of stuff. I find myself, you know, like, I think if we want to live in a free society, we have to imagine how a free society would work. And a broad-based tolerance towards a whole range of education, class, race, you know, everything, you know, I think, you know, has to just sort of come along with that.
Okay, I mean, I feel that, I feel you there, Jeffrey, but I also, like, I have to admit that I feel like there is some sort of, like, there are some cultural superiorities. When I say, like, well, you could say Western values, for example, things like,
right.
You know, like, liberalism is a cultural value that I think is a superior value. And I feel like there's people want to try and say, well, my culture is just as good as yours, in a sense, like this culture is just as good as yours. And there's a feeling pushed towards subjectivity of morality in a lot of ways. And I think that's not true, you know? I mean, come on, you're a Catholic. You're a Dapper Dan man, you know? Like, you must think that there is some superiority in your bourgeois culture, which I happen to agree with you in a lot of ways. It doesn't mean I want to tell other people how to live, but inherently there are more moral ways to live. Don't you see that?
Hey, Aston, you know, the first time I think you and I got together in a studio, the first thing I did was retie your tie, so of course.
So there's a better way to do things. All right, you showed me, Jeffrey, you showed me. All right, I won't push you on this anymore, but this has been a fantastic interview. Jeffrey, is there anything that you'd like to plug, any websites you'd like to tell people about or anything?
Yeah, we're developing an amazing community at liberty.me. I'm so thrilled. I wanted to build a city in the sky, but now it's all populated. We're all there hanging out, learning from each other and sharing information together. So I would enjoy it, you know, appreciate it. If anybody wants to come over and try out for a 30-day free trial, you're welcome to join us. I think you'll find it riveting, amazing, and really life beneficial. That's my own view. And I hope to see you at Bitcoin in the Beltway this weekend. If not, I'll look forward to talking to you again soon.
Jeffrey Tucker, Chief Liberty Officer of Liberty.me. Jeff, thanks a lot for coming.
Pleasure to see you. Bye-bye.
Have a good one.